This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Joseph Tye, he's a constitutional law professor at the University of Oklahoma. He has served as a law clerk to two Supreme Court justices, John Paul Stevens and Byron White. And as an assistant attorney general in Massachusetts, he graduated from Harvard Law School and Harvard College. Joe, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Absolutely, thanks for spending some time with us. So Elena Kagan is the president's pick to replace John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court. Who is this, and what's your read on the nomination?
Well, I think it's a strong nomination from both a legal standpoint and a political standpoint. And barring any unforeseen revelations or unexpected gotcha moments, I think it will likely be a successful nomination. Elena Kagan, of course, is the current Solicitor General of the United States. That means that she is the lawyer that argues the interests of the United States before the Supreme Court. Before that, she was the Dean of Harvard Law School and historically one of its most successful and well-beloved deans. She comes to the confirmation process with a wealth of legal experience, not only as SG, but as Solicitor General and as an attorney inside the Clinton White House. She has sterling academic credentials, graduated from Princeton and from Harvard Law School, and served as a law clerk to Justice Thurgood Marshall.
So why this woman? I mean, what is it? What do you think that was the calculus going on in the White House that would say, "Yep, you know, Elena Kagan, she's our pick."
Well, the stars aligned for her in several different ways. First of all, the lack of a paper trail certainly helps in this modern day of confirmation hearings, where it's largely filled with gotcha moments and attempts to bring down a candidate based upon a stray statement from a long paper trail. She has also been a unifier at Harvard Law School. I attended Harvard Law School back in the mid-90s, and there was a period of detente there. In the 80s and early 90s, Harvard Law School was famous for its ideological battles among the law faculty. It was kind of like the Middle East. and when I was there, the faculty were entering a period of detente where they kind of left each other alone, but also left students alone. She came in the later on after I left and unified the law faculty. She also brought in some prominent conservative professors to balance the ideological mixture of the faculty. And she improved the quality of student life and renewed the law school's commitment to public service. And all of that made her extremely popular. On the other hand, she also held her political views very close to her vest. And yeah, I think that helped her lead Harvard Law School from a non-ideological perspective, and it also makes her a good nominee because she hasn't really gone out on a limb and expressed her views on some of the most hot-button and controversial political issues of the day. She did, however, come out strongly opposed to the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy while she was dean at Harvard Law School. And I think that can create some trouble for her going into the confirmation process, but I don't think that it's a deal breaker. The other star that is aligned in her favor is her age. She's only 50 years old. The man that she replaced, my former boss, Justice Stevens, was 55 years old when he was nominated. Back then, ironically, the concern with him was not with legal credentials. He had sterling credentials like Kagan, but with his age, they thought, being 55, you know, he wouldn't be on the court for very long, but of course he had the last laugh and has been on the court for 35 years. She's only 50, and so she has potentially a whole generation to grow in importance and influence. Also, she's already been through the Senate confirmation process once, and she's gotten some bipartisan support, if not overwhelming bipartisan support. She had to be confirmed as Solicitor General, and several Republican senators ended up siding with her, even though they had expressed some concerns about her don't ask, don't tell stance. And so she's been vetted both by the White House and by the Senate once before.
Yeah, so we'll certainly see the staunch conservatives in the Senate do what they do and come out right away and say, there's no way I would ever support this woman.
Sure, but then you'll see her doing what nominees do as well. This is just political theater. I mean, no, the sets are the same, the script is the same. You have different actors reading different lines, but at the very end of the process, what you end up getting is political posturing on the Senate side and very deft deflection of questions on the nominee side. It's what's been happening since the time of Robert Bork, and you know, the nominee that goes through that process and says something that sinks his or her nomination, you know, is one that probably, quite frankly, shouldn't have been tapped in the first place, because you have to have a certain degree of skill and restraint at deflecting hard questions when you come before the Senate for this grueling process.
We're honored to be talking with Joseph Tai. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of Oklahoma, and he clerked for two Supreme Court justices. Let me ask you about your former boss, who's retiring from the court, John Paul Stevens. Share with us, take us behind the scenes, behind those closed doors. What's he like? And tell us a little bit about the significance of his tenure and his legacy on the court.
Sure. Well, let me just give you first a little biography of Justice Stevens. He comes from the greatest generation. He was a World War II veteran. He was a naval intelligence officer at Pearl Harbor. He's also a Midwesterner. He comes from Chicago, and so he has a Midwestern sense of pragmatism. He was first nominated and elevated to the federal appellate court bench in Chicago by President Nixon, and then 5 years later, just in the wake of Watergate, President Ford was looking for a non-ideological nominee who could unify the country after the wounds of Watergate, and he was confirmed in short order in about 3 weeks, a unanimous vote, 98-0, and as I said, the only controversy behind him was the fact that he was 35 years old, which back then seemed to be, you know, older than an optimal Supreme Court nominee should be, but as we've seen, that's in hindsight wasn't a real concern with him. He approached judging the old-fashioned way. He comes from a long tradition of common law judicial restraint. What that means is that he approached cases one case at a time. He liked to decide cases based on their facts. He distrusted absolute principles and abstract theories. He liked to decide cases, you know, just based upon reason and based upon analysis as to what the consequences of the decision might be in the real world. And he liked to be careful and not decide more than he had to, just to give future judges as well as Democratic actors more room to decide and to legislate in the future. And it's a bit of a contrast now, I think, to the modern-day conservatives on the court. They tend to be bolder, and they tend to prefer bright categorical rules. And so it's a different kind of judging that you're seeing on the court now than with Justice Stevens. One anecdote that I like to tell about Justice Stevens is that when we law clerks helped him to decide cases, we could never really predict with any degree of accuracy, although it was a lot of fun, how he would come out in any particular case. He would just read the briefs and go through the record and go through the cases himself, and he expected us to do that in parallel. And then we'd all gather around in the law clerk's office. He sat in this little black armchair of his. And before he told us what he thought, he always asked us what we thought first, and you know, he listened to all of us, and then he would express his views. And usually he would point out facts that we'd overlooked or legal considerations that we had not thought of or grappled with hard enough. And he really exhibited a habit of understanding before disagreeing, which I think is a rare habit nowadays, and it's certainly one that I haven't quite developed. But he really was the model, in my view, of the open-minded judge. And I think it'll be difficult to find someone with those credentials as well as with that kind of commitment to keeping an open mind.
We're talking with Joe Tai. He's a constitutional law professor at the University of Oklahoma. Joe, we have an attorney general in Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, who has joined other attorneys general in America in opposing the federal health care legislation on the grounds that it violates the Constitution. And we've heard reference to the 10th Amendment. Let me read that really quickly to remind people what it is, and then get your thoughts about this whole idea of federalism and the 10th Amendment as it relates to some of these issues. The 10th Amendment reads that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, first, if I can preface my thoughts, let me just say that it's hard to discuss the 10th Amendment and the constitutionality of the health care law objectively because there's so much anger and so much rhetoric from both sides of the political aisle. That said, I think that as a legal matter, it's fairly easy to assess whether or not the health care bill is constitutional and whether or not these lawsuits will succeed. The short answer is, under current case law, well-established case law, the health care bill will likely be upheld in federal court, and therefore these lawsuits will likely fail. But as a political matter, it might make a great deal of sense anyway to pursue these lawsuits. Now, what some people don't understand, particularly non-lawyers, and perhaps politicians overlook this, is that we're not writing on a blank slate when we're looking at the Constitution, when we're reading the text of the Tenth Amendment, as you just read. We also have to consider about 200 years of constitutional history, of constitutional interpretation as given by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has construed the Constitution from early on in the 19th century the Tenth Amendment. The Supreme Court has construed the Tenth Amendment from early on in the 19th century to essentially be a negative reservation of power to the states rather than an affirmative grant of power to the federal government. The great Chief Justice John Marshall, he was a Virginian, I believe, he basically read the Tenth Amendment to save for the states the powers that have not already been delegated to the federal government by the other parts of the Constitution. So if the Constitution lets Congress do something, then the Tenth Amendment does not prohibit it. So the first step in asking whether or not something violates the Tenth Amendment is to ask whether or not the Constitution gives Congress the power to do it somewhere else.
And does the Constitution give Congress the power to create this federal health care legislation that they recently voted on?
Well, again, here we have to go back to the time of John Marshall. The short answer is yes. John Marshall, back in the early 1800s, interpreted the Constitution to give Congress very broad powers to regulate interstate commerce, and that was the view that the court held for much of the 19th century. Towards the end of the 19th century, early into the 20th century, the Supreme Court read the Tenth Amendment more broadly and the Commerce Clause more narrowly and started to strike down economic regulations passed by Congress, such as child labor laws. But since the 1930s, the court has generally very broadly construed Congress's power to regulate commerce, and that includes power to regulate even activities that do not cross state lines, that are purely local, but that have a substantial effect on the national economy in the aggregate. Just to give an example of the famous case that everyone cites to and tries to distinguish, it's the case of Wickard v. Filburn, where the Supreme Court said that Congress even had the power to prohibit a farmer from growing wheat in his own backyard for his own personal home consumption. And the constitutional theory behind that case was that, well, if everyone across the country grew wheat in their own backyard for their own personal consumption, that would have a substantial effect on the national wheat market. And Congress has the power to regulate the national wheat market, therefore it has the power to regulate even this purely local, purely personal activity.
Amazing.
It is amazing, and it was recently reaffirmed in 2005 in the context of medical marijuana. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by my former boss, John Paul Stevens, held that Congress could regulate the local manufacture and sales of marijuana because there is a national, albeit black, market for marijuana based on the same theory as Wickard v. Filburn. Now, there have been attacks on this breathtaking theory of commerce power. For example, the Rehnquist Court chipped around the edges. For example, it held in one case that Congress could not regulate the possession of guns near schools, because the mere possession of guns near schools is not an economic activity. The Rehnquist Court also held about a decade ago that Congress cannot ban violence against women on the theory that it affects interstate commerce because violence against women is a non-economic local activity. But those were just cases that chipped at the margins, and it really didn't undercut the core of congressional commerce power. And so I think it's fairly safe to say, given the percentage of GDP that healthcare occupies, that it easily qualifies as part of Congress's Commerce Clause power. One distinction that these lawsuits try to draw and that supporters of these lawsuits try to draw is between federal power to prohibit something and federal power to require something. For example, I think your Attorney General has pointed out that, well, you know, it's one thing for the federal government to say you can't grow wheat in your backyard, but it's another thing to require people to buy health care insurance. That's certainly what local politicians here in Oklahoma have tried to argue. But that distinction is not really one that you find in the text of the 10th Amendment that you read, nor is it found in the Commerce Clause, and more importantly, it's not found in the case law. The cases that have upheld congressional regulation in the commercial and economic area in the 20th century, they really haven't drawn a distinction between prohibiting something and requiring something. And indeed, if that is the relevant constitutional distinction, then it would bleed over to other areas of law that I cannot see the court striking down. For example, federal civil rights or anti-discrimination laws, laws that, for example, prohibit restaurants and hotels from discriminating on the basis of race, gender, or creed. Do those laws merely prohibit restaurants from discriminating, or do they require restaurants and other public accommodations to affirmatively serve clients regardless of their race, et cetera? And so those laws, other types of economic regulations, environmental regulations, health and safety regulations, on the one hand, you can say that the glass is half empty and they merely prohibit something. But on the other hand, you can very easily flip it around and say, well, the glass is half full and they're requiring something. And that's really not a distinction that you find in the case law.
Interesting. So the court's not really going to be focusing on that so much as the larger issues of the Commerce Clause for Congress.
I think so. And, it's interesting that here, or at least there, you're in Virginia because really the great debate about the scope of congressional power was early on in our country's history between two Virginians, between Thomas Jefferson on the one hand, who had a more robust view of states' rights and believed that the federal government was much more limited in its authority, and John Marshall, who was a Federalist who believed in a strong national government and who ended up getting the first word and, as a result, the last word, at least so far as Supreme Court case law is concerned, about the scope of federal power under the Commerce Clause. John Marshall got to decide some of the early and influential and foundational cases that basically very broadly construed the constitutional power of Congress to regulate commerce. Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson later on opposed that view, but they weren't on the court and they didn't get to write the law, and the law is still in the books.
Joseph Tai is a constitutional law professor at the University of Oklahoma. He's clerked for two Supreme Court justices and has served as an assistant attorney general in Massachusetts. Joe, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I'll look forward to having you back on the program. We've got a lot still to discuss.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and sorry if I rambled on.
No, not at all. Thank you. Joseph Tai, he's at University of Oklahoma.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.